Heidi Holton, thanks for choosing this KAXE-KBXE conversation. We are member-supported radio, a National Public Radio affiliate in northern Minnesota. We need your support for our radio broadcasts, our online content, and our podcast. Go to KAXE.org, and thanks for listening.
So let's go to the extra, and let's talk about the Green New Deal.
Okay.
And I think we should do an upcoming episode just about income inequality. I think at some point we should do that and delve into that, because I both think we agree that it is a problem. Mm-hmm. And more than income inequality, wealth inequality is a problem. And how we would go about dealing with that, because I think that's a fundamental issue.
No, I agree.
But let's talk about the Green New Deal.
Okay, in the extra.
How do you do the overtime?
Well, there's a red box you have to open, and there's a hammer inside, and you crack the glass with it. And no, I'm kidding.
We just start talking now, and then this becomes the extra.
So, like, stop. So, and now we're in the extra.
So put your microphone on.
Put your mic on, because, Scott, you can come in on. I know you've been coy and very demure about your participation, but this is where all bets are off.
Yeah, all bets are off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
You can swear. No, we never do. We never do, but we could.
You could curse. We all...
Yeah, probably not. They'll bleep it because someone will download it and be offended. So maybe we won't swear. But this is the extra.
Mm-hmm. I'm. Have you read this? Because I went through and read.
I read a description of it. I've not read the. You've got the serious whole thing there.
Here's the interesting thing about media today. I read a description of it as well from left-wing media, and then I read a description of it from right-wing media. And I'm like, they're not talking about the same document. They're talking about two different things. So I went and read it myself because I'm like, this is small enough to be primary source material. And it is fascinating to me how it's not a bill, right? It's basically an aspirational statement.
Yeah, it'd be like a pamphlet, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating to me how it is very much in the Engels, Lenin, Marx kind of framework. It is, here's how we will magically solve every problem of humanity in one fell, in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We will, end all coal, build high-speed rail everywhere. We will, hire the people who will do it. Not only, that was the one that was interesting to me. It's the, they've got a term for the groups of people who would be out doing this stuff. And it's, everything from the indigenous to the rural left behind to the, every aggrieved group is listed individually in here. Mm-hmm. Oh, here we go. This is all going to be done by indigenous communities, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialized communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, low-income workers, women, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities and youth, which is basically like the proletariat.
Yeah. Yeah, the proletariat. Yeah.
And so this to me was a document that would have felt very comfortable in 1918, Russia. There's a part of it that for me, I kind of laugh at because as a true policy document, it's kind of ridiculous. It's kind of silly. But there's another part of me that understands that this is not a policy document. This is a cultural statement of values.
It's a statement of values, maybe political values as well as cultural values. But let me – so let's flip
– do it.
So I'm not going to
– I don't want you to defend the Green New Deal. I'm not asking you to
do it. And I didn't come here to do it because I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah.
A lot of the things seem what I would describe as pie in the sky. A lot of the things seem like, okay, you're just taking – the most optimal vision of a liberal policy and enacting it somehow through we got to get a Congress elected, a Senate elected, and a president elected who are going to support this document. And even if 2020 goes great for the Democrats, I don't predict that all of those things are going to come up exactly that way.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Yeah.
But don't lose that thought. But I think what I find fascinating is that the new green idea is that the climate change is the existential problem,
It connects climate change to economic insecurity in all its manifestations.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, I think, the remarkable thing about the Green New Deal as a policy or as whatever it is, as a concept, as a marketing concept, really, a right. political marketing concept, is that it connects two things that we all seem to argue about the reality of, which is A, is climate change real? Is the environment, are we facing environmental destruction? And B, what about all of the people who are left out of this great economy we supposedly have?
And let me just point out, I think your belief on A depends a lot on where you see yourself in B.
Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a generational thing too. I think young people, maybe not all young people, and certainly not all, you know, obviously in conservative areas, young people might see things a little differently than those in urban areas. But young people have a fatalistic attitude about all this stuff that's like, oh my, we're going to be in boats. We're going to be, it's going to be horrible because, and we got no power to deal with it because grandpa doesn't like liberals.
So bring on the guillotine.
Yeah, right.
No, that's
but it's much more personal than that. It's not like bring out the guillotine. It's like this, this notion of your own family being divided against itself, and you don't want to guillotine anybody. You want it to just get a bit better.
But it is. And that's mm-hmm. the problem is that every time you see in history, these bloody, nasty revolutions is when not only there is income and wealth inequality, which we have now, yes, mm-hmm. but you also don't have faith in the system like correcting itself.
Yeah.
You're sitting there looking
at it. It's hopeless, so let's do something crazy.
Yeah, you're sitting there looking at the chessboard. You're two steps away from checkmate. You can't, there's nothing you can do about it. So what do? You flip over the chessboard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's right. When you get crazy.
The boat is sinking. Get some kind of piece of furniture and float away on it. Yeah.
And I think if we were to look historically at FDR, I think the conservative argument for FDR was an insight that said, okay, we could be months, years away from flipping over the chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to, like, look, all you business people and whatever, you know.
Well, back in that episode, I think that we were driving at that is that FDR's response, you know, FDR, who was an economic elite in real life, and who started maybe certainly not warm to socialism in a real sense, was persuaded partly by his wife, partly by the conditions, to introduce kind of a thin solution of socialism in order to prevent something much more drastic from happening. And maybe it worked, you know, historically, we can look at that.
Well, and I think this is why you saw a lot of Republicans in the last election supporting Hillary Clinton. A lot of like the Bill Crystals and the neocons.
Yeah, the intellectual Republicans.
Yeah, intellectual Republicans, because they're looking at like, you know, saying this is like the rabble coming
mm-hmm.
to burn this place down.
Yeah.
And if you ask the rabble, like, why are you voting for Donald Trump? They would say, because we want to burn the place down.
Yeah.
I mean, they were not shy about that.
Yeah.
And now you have from the other side, the group coming in saying, we want to burn this place down. And, you know, in its place, we're going to recreate, mm-hmm. you know, this different vision of an equitable, just, fair world. And yeah, we might have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, but hey, that's, you know, those people have had a good run for a long time. Let me, without trying to sound defensive, white males have had a good run for a long time. It's time they get knocked down a few pegs. And that's just the way it's mm-hmm. going to be, you know, because that's going to be fair.
That's the perception that drives so much of the resentment that people feel.
Right.
What if, you know, it's kind of, you ever pull into a parking place? You're pulling into a parking place and you get right to where you're situated and you're about to hit park. And right as you're about to park, the person next to you is reversing out of their parking place. And it feels like you're still going forward.
It freaks you out.
And it freaks you out. Like, oh my God, my brakes are out. What's happening? I'm going to crash.
Right.
It's a perception issue. Mm-hmm. You are in park. Everything is fine. But there's a perception that you're not fine.
Right.
And I think a lot of what's happening in the world, and I mean the world, not just the United States, is we've been remarkably prosperous, remarkably productive over the past 50 to 100 years.
And let me just inject, I think capitalism has created a lot of prosperity.
You know what?
It's also created income inequality, but it's created a lot of prosperity.
We have a system that has generated what you would call wealth,
yep.
What you would call innovation, technology. I mean, I'm reading about 1915 and 1900, and I'm reading about people dying left and right from diseases that we could fix right now if they had access to current technology and all sorts of things, hardships that don't exist now, even among the poor, because of whatever. And you know what we call capitalism? I'm going to give you that one, Chuck.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we're watching is, and white men figured it out first, because they happened to have the catbird seat at the time all this stuff blew up. So you had a masculine culture, and with powerful people from Europe who were mostly white, and
in the right place at the right place,
right time, and they're they get India, they get all the countries around the world, they get South America, they get Africa, and they just. The happenstance of history and anthropology all kind of coalesce right there. So as we're figuring this out, and as other people in the world, not just European-centric people, are figuring out how to innovate using capitalism and other things, and as others are catching up in Asia and China and in Middle East, that means that other people are doing better. And Bill Gates was just out talking about this the week we're recording this, talking about how amazingly prosperous, how much prosperity has been diffused out to populations that used to have none just in the last 10 years. You know,
right.
Despite whatever you think about what's the state of our country, there's a lot of people doing better than they've ever done all over the world. That's not equal. It's not fair. There's still problems. There's still genocide. There's still all these problems. But lots of things are going well, too. As that's happening, and as that has happened at different times in American history, as we've watched more women and people of color get elected to offices and all of this, there's that perception, just like pulling into a parking place as somebody else is pulling out, that your ship is sailing and other people's ship is coming in. And there's that sense that I think drives a lot of the cultural perception that they're out to get us. If you're doing okay and you're living in the country, probably you're fine. And whatever they do in the metro area probably doesn't even affect you. But the perception that they might take their bag policies and come and get you with them, so you can't use them plastic bags that you like to use, is like the perception of they're all out to get me, you know. And it might not actually be that way. But that's not what I would. So this has been a lovely conversation. But I wanted to talk about something back in the Green New Deal. Can I go back? I don't know where we're going to end this. This could go on,
Scott. You're just sitting back now.
So you mentioned like all of the aggrieved populations that would perform the tasks of this Green New Deal that's written into that document, and I like to point out this example, and I always get these blank stares. Like we have no concept of it, but. I'll just use the example of non-ferrous mining in northern Minnesota, which is a type of controversy. Hell, let's do socialism and non-ferrous mining in northern Minnesota and really cover our bases of controversy. But we know it as a cultural battle, a titanic battle between environmental, urban liberals and right-minded, common-sense blue-blooded Iron Rangers who just want to work for a living and restore the great culture of the past through this mine. And that's how I experienced that. Maybe that's not how you, the listener, see it, but as a person living on the range, this is the world I live in. This is the deal. And I was really fascinated over the fact that just north of the border, a few 30 miles from Fort Francis, Ontario, right over the border, the international border, there is a holy heck gold mine that has opened. It is producing gold right now. It's new. Just this year, they're producing gold, a non-ferrous mineral using some of the same techniques that PolyMet and others want to use here in northern Minnesota to great controversy. And yet, it happened quietly. There is not as much drama in Canada. I mean, there is certainly, the environmentalists didn't like it. I'm not trying to paint like it's perfect. Everybody's happy in Canada. But Justin Trudeau, the Liberal prime minister, supported it The Liberal Party supported it. The Liberal member of parliament supports it in his constituency. He was elected in the government that Justin Trudeau was elected in. And it's broadly, locally seen as a good thing. And I asked the guy, Don Rusnik, the member of parliament from Thunder Bay, riding right next to this district where this happened. I asked him, like, what was the deal? Why is that the case? And he said, well, we included more of the environmental community on the discussion early, and particularly the indigenous community, and we promised them a certain number of jobs in the plant. We promised the indigenous community a certain number of jobs in the plant, and they supported us. That was the difference. Now, I'm not saying that it's that easy to do that here. Maybe there's different policies. The Canadian government is a little different than ours. But what if it's that simple?
Right.
What if it's about inclusion? What if it's about include? Because a lot of what we see in the cultural battle in northern Minnesota is this has become a battle of, you know, well, if I make my living and my life, not just my living, but my life off of wild rice and the natural traditional lifestyle of the Ojibwe people of northern Minnesota, and I'm going to risk that for what? A job that I don't get? For that other people get? If anybody gets it, I don't get it. And so it's an either-or proposition. Either I get my wild rice or I get nothing. Either I get my job at the mine or I get nothing. And that's an impossible conversation. That's just name any controversial American issue and you have some kind of end game, no solution problem like that.
I think you're right.
And I'm just picking out one piece of language out of this Green New Deal that you keyed in on too.
Yeah.
This part I don't dismiss because I think we're entering into an era of great employment problems because of automation, because of, you know, we're coming up on truck drivers going away.
Yeah.
We're coming up on all kinds of jobs. Truck driver is the number one job in most states in the United States, including ours, Minnesota. Truck driver, number one profession. What if it goes away and instead of XYZ truck drivers, we have XYZ minus 90% automated trucking control operators, and they get paid twice as well as truckers, but there's 10 times fewer of them. And what if this happens in all these industries? What the hell are all of these people going to do? Mm-hmm. What's my grandpa going to do? What's the 1960s version of my grandpa in 2024 going to do for a living? And I can put a face and a name on it for my community, people I know. And the answer is we gotta give people something to do. My sister, again, just using anecdotal evidence, my sister's been traveling. She's going to be trying to move to Italy, a whole other story there. But she spent 3 months there trying to get work permits to work because her significant other lives there. And so she had this period of time where she couldn't legally work, but she was there. And she described, like, emotionally the feeling of not having a job, of, yeah, you have this beautiful country and this place to be, and let's say you've even got enough money to live and survive and food and access to the things you need. But something was missing, and that is a purpose. And I think a whole generation of Americans is coming up on this question of what is our purpose? And even if in policy, this policy in particular, you create a system by which people have what they need, I think what they really need is a purpose. And I think maybe that's an area of agreement.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Let me take that in a different... Let me start with agreeing with you on that.
Okay.
And let me also just, you know, so people listening understand too, the list that of you know, aggrieved parties that I read from the Green New Deal, I'm not making an argument that they don't have a right to be aggrieved or that they shouldn't be aggrieved.
Oh, no, and I didn't...
You didn't say that.
I didn't mean to
insinuate that. No, you didn't say that at all. But I want to start with the idea that they are righteously aggrieved.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they are righteously aggrieved. The language in here is they've suffered systematic economic injustices. And I'm willing to posit that. Like, that, yes, mm-hmm. that is true. Yes, that is true. So the question becomes one of, you know, what then? And you, I think, point out the human part of this, which is humans, to flourish, need to feel that they have value, mm-hmm. that they are respected, that they have value as individuals. And what capitalism does not do a good job of is for people who are marginalized, showing them respect or value. It does really great with if you're Steve Jobs and come up with something innovative, mm-hmm. or if you have a lot of money and capital and can invest that places. There's a lot of ways of showing you respect and making you feel empowered and making you have value and mm-hmm. worth. But if you are not an innovator, you're just someone who's willing to work hard and go about their business. Capitalism does not treat you very well, especially globalization plus capitalism.
And I think capitalism is unfair to those without capital the way track is unfair to people who can't run fast.
Right, right.
But the problem is capitalism is what runs our whole system.
And capitalism has created a ton of wealth and prosperity. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about it. In some ways, to me, socialism is like eating your seed corn, right? Like capitalism does create all this growth and innovation. It also creates economic inequality. So if you want to reduce economic inequality, you're not going to do that without also reducing innovation and, mm-hmm. and entrepreneurship. So there's this trade-off, and it's mm-hmm. always like, how much of your seed corn do you want to eat? I think there's another aspect of this, though, and I think this gets to the kind of underlying assumptions of our economic system today, and that has to do with just growth in general. When you talk about African countries. And Bill Gates saying, look at all the good that has been done now.
It's not yet equal, but gains are being made.
Yeah. Huge gains are being made. Look mm-hmm. at this. I often sometimes think about, like, what would someone living in a poor country, what would someone living in the rural parts of India who looked at the United States and saw us arguing over income inequality or wealth inequality, mm-hmm. What would they say? Because it's a little bit like, two people who, you remember this growing up as a kid, is like someone's making $100,000 a year, someone's making $200,000 a year. They're arguing over something.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm sitting here in poverty. Like that's
I've got a Lincoln, but I can't afford a BMW.
Right, right, yeah. right. And so I think that one of the things that capitalism has done, so you've talked about marketing in the past. I think capitalism plus marketing and capitalism plus globalization. One thing that it has done to our culture is made us into these people who must consume. Mm-hmm. And if we don't consume in ever ravenous amounts, our economy falls apart.
Yeah.
Like it stops working.
Yeah, if everybody just lived nicely in a house and had just the very basics of what they needed,
and even
we'd be ruined.
Yes. If we all had, I mean, I look at myself, if I had, immense gratitude for the fact that I have like a 60-inch TV screen and mm-hmm. I can watch whatever program I want on demand, I have, a safe vehicle that can get me around. Mm-hmm. I can go to the store and get food. There are all these things that for people even like 30 years ago in the United States would have been seen as like miracles. Mm-hmm. And I just live in this sea of miracles. And I am constantly fed this stream of you don't have enough. It's not good enough. Mm-hmm. I'm not some utopian ideologue who thinks, well, just like stop telling everybody should just be happy. That's belittling income inequality, which I do think that there's a huge issue here because some people have none or are in a place where they really, really struggle. Mm-hmm. I think we have to transition our economy away from dependence on debt, dependence on growth, into something that would be more of a steady state economy. And let me use this analogy because this is one of my favorite ways to describe this. Right now, our economy is like a person riding a bike. You have to keep it moving forward. And the faster you go, actually, the more stable it becomes. But as soon as you start to slow down, and oh, God help us, if you stop, you're going to collapse and the whole thing will
wobble,
fall apart.
Wobble, wobble. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We need to transition our economy to be more like someone standing. And when you're standing, you're stable.
You're as stable as can be.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's the rub with that. And I think we can agree on that. Like, that would be a better economy. One more. Here's the rub with that. It's only in moving that you can move things around. Mm-hmm. Right? It's only in, and the reason we created this economy the way it was is because after we came out of the Depression, we did have huge income and inequality. We did have huge wealth inequalities, and we had, you know, we needed to create a lot of wealth. We built this middle class. And now what we've seen is that it's atrophied. And the sad thing is we didn't ever look and say, this is good. We made it. Mm-hmm. Keynes, when he wrote in the 30s, said, you know, at some point in the future, businesses will be like universities. They'll be just be out for the public good. And people will work 20 hours a week and have all this time for mm-hmm. leisurely things. We actually could have done that. Like, we have the wealth and affluence to live that.
We could do it right now. If we really wanted to do it, we could do it right now.
We could do it right now. But we have this economy that doesn't allow us to do mm-hmm. that. And we're kind of, in a way, stuck.
It's the beast that feeds, and we have to feed the beast. And we're all a part of it. And
we are, the way I would describe it is, we created this economy to serve us. And we've gotten to the point now where we serve it. And that's the fundamental imbalance.
Do you get a sense that maybe this is, I think there's something too in the culture, all of this dystopian fiction that we're experiencing. And I would include the zombie phenomenon of The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Up until now, all the dystopian Handmaid's Tale, and there's just been a lot of dystopian, you know, end of the world, it all falls apart kind of thinking. And climate change as a debate kind of feeds into that too.
I struggle with climate change, not because I doubt the science, but because I doubt the humanity and our inclinations in that way in talking about the science.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's always been my problem with climate change, the conversation.
The conversation about it, yeah. But I think, and this is bringing it back to the Green New Deal, and I don't know, we've got to, just like the economy, we got to stop at some point, I guess. this is some point where, I don't know, if you're listening, podcast listener,
yeah,
God bless you.
I honor you.
You've really done something here. But I kind of feel like there's something behind the dystopian nature of our cultural thinking right now, and the notion that there is a connection between the environmental and the economic, which is what this is. In a way, it's kind of a dystopian document in that it's designed to give you the sense, real or perceived, that we're in trouble and that this is our last chance to do something. That's why they put a date on it, 10 years. And why I think...
And the rhetoric around it is, in 12 years, this will be irreversible.
Do you follow the gritty memes? The Philadelphia Flyers, Flyers mascot. Oh, the gritty memes. All right. Well, I can't describe it other than there's bizarre mascot from the Philadelphia Flyers. This fuzzy mascot is really kind of menacing, but also welcoming, and it's kind of strange. And it went from being this weird thing to now it's kind of been adopted the way Pepe the Frog was adopted by the white nationalist. Now,
yeah.
the socialist internet has adopted Gritty,
okay,
as like a meme, an image of their point of view. And it kind of has, there's this repetitive thing, and they put different words in it, but they're using Muppets, okay? So the first Muppet is like a friendly-looking Muppet, and then there's kind of a disheveled-looking Muppet, Animal, for the drummer from the Muppets, followed by Gritty, who is this just
evil looking
big eyes, menacing looking thing. And it starts with like, oh, you know, there's income inequality, as the little mellow guy is like, there's income inequality. And the slightly more disheveled guy is like, you know, something must be done about this. And Animal is like, you know, workers need to get together. And then Gritty is like, either we solve climate change or we'll all be dead in 10 years. You know, like this like most extreme version of this thing. And I kind of feel like this is the reason the memes or culture are so popular. And look at Donald Trump, who is the meme president.
Right. He's a presidential meme.
He's a meme.
Right.
He got voted for by memes.
Right.
Memes got him elected, whether they came from Russia or
right.
or Mississippi. Uh-huh. It was a meme that got him elected. memes about Clinton, memes about poor people, everything got Trump elected. And he is a living, all he can do is speak and appear in memes. Everything he does is a meme. And this is kind of like the left's, I feel, and you might feel the opposite, but I feel like this way this legislation has come forward is a lot like the left's response to Donald Trump.
I think absolutely. And that, I think every fear you have about Donald Trump should, because what this, this was always my argument with 1930s Germany. We focus on Adolf Hitler as this like evil person who went on to do all these evil things. And we say we can't ever have another Hitler. And I think what we lose in that conversation is that Hitler was the analog to a crazy leftist conversation that was going on there. And they were in this huge tug of war. And that,
well, and that there were many chances that Germany had to say no to Hitler.
There were.
Or right. to stop him.
Right.
But for various reasons that seemed very that seemed very sane at the time, they didn't, you know.
And this is where, and I'll say this, I got beat up a little bit this week on Facebook by some people who were demanding to know who I voted for president in 2016. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I've already talked about this. Like, I voted for Gary Johnson. I didn't vote for Trump. But they wanted to know, did you support Trump? Because for them, that was like a litmus test
yeah.
of whether you're a decent human being or not. It's fascinating to me because if you said, I am going to run. Like, if we had Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez running for president, she's not mm-hmm. eligible.
She's too young. Age, yeah.
But mm-hmm. if she was running and this was her platform, or Bernie Sanders says, like, this is my platform, I will vote for Trump. And I don't want to vote for Trump. I think Trump is bad for everything that I believe in. I think he is horrible. But if you gave me two mm-hmm. choices, a totalitarian left, a totalitarian right.
And a lot of people who vote, I'm going to say this just as a peace offering to a lot of people who did vote for Trump. I think some people, whether I would agree with their perception or not,
right.
felt that it was that kind of a thing when Hillary was running. Mm-hmm. You know, and they felt about Hillary the way you might feel about Cortez or you know, and that there was no choice. And a relative of mine said the words, we didn't speak much of it, but he said, what choice did we have?
What choice did we have? And I
don't agree with that, and I got a lot of arguments, and I think a lot of it was unfair and blah blah blah. But so what? The game's over. You know, it right. happened, and that's what happened. That's what people did, and I just feel like we're seeing that happen. And the thing is, you might maybe it gets you to vote for Trump, if it's some extreme thing. Maybe a lot of other people show up to vote. Maybe the crazy thing happens anyway. And right. what if this just keeps happening like this?
Well, this you is know. Why, and I'll put in this plug for Dig Deep and for KXE. This is the reason I do this show with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do think that it is very important for people in our listening area, in Minnesota, internationally, galaxy-wide, who are getting this podcast, I think it's important to hear two people who basically vote differently, sit down and have a reasoned yeah. discussion about these topics, because I feel like that's the only way we fix this. This is the only way we break through this
yeah.
is to actually recognize some common humanity and the fact that, you know, we can agree on goals mm-hmm. And we can find non-guillotine ways of getting there.
Yeah. I think I'll just echo what you said. I mean, some people voted for Trump in this last election. Okay. We know this.
They did.
It definitely happened. And from this, we have to figure out a way where a governing majority includes some people who voted for Trump.
Right.
And for a lot of people on the left, and I'm a leftist. Okay. Right. So I'll agree on many matters of policy with Representative Cortez. I mean, I admire things about her, but it's the either or nobody else but kind of thinking that I think it wasn't good for the Republican Party.
We can clearly see that. I mean, Democrats for years said the Tea Party's taken over. Yeah. They're crazy.
And it wasn't good for the Republican Party.
Right.
And I have no idea why it would be good for the Democratic Party to have the same thing happen to them. Because right now, I think you need a coalition a party, because the Democratic Party's been in rough shape. So has the Republican Party, I guess, in times past. But like after the Civil War, the Democratic Party was a hot mess of half racists, half city politicians, and it was just a mess. And the Republican Party was a governing coalition party for that time, and I think the country was better for it.
Right.
I'd say that as a Minnesotan, we were a product of that.
Yeah.
That, you know, we were the model citizen of that era, Minnesota. But I think the Democratic Party has a moment here where it needs to be the Democratic small D party that is for democracy and has the coalition, and that means it's gonna have to tolerate. It's already the multicultural party. It's going to have to tolerate a lot of different kinds of people. So why can't it tolerate variations on a theme? But what I'm seeing is the opposite.
I'm seeing that too, and that's what scares
me. And that concerns me. Speaking as a guy who, the liberal of this program, who detests what Trump stands for and will happily vote for a bag of rice that might run against him, anything, you know, inanimate objects, toilet plungers that we might nominate, I'll vote for it. But it freaks me out. And a lot of Democrats, I think, are in a perpetual state of being freaked out, because when a Democrat runs for office, announces, like Amy Klobuchar did recently and Bernie Sanders on the day we're recording here today, there's a whole host of people who are Democratic voters saying, oh, we can't be nominating this person because of this.
We can't
this
vote
this.
For Amy Klobuchar. She's too much of a pragmatist.
Too moderate. And Bernie Sanders is not racially sensitive enough.
Right.
And somebody else, Cory Booker, is too in bed with the banks because he's from New Jersey. And I can list you every single Democratic candidate and a reason Democrats say not to vote for that person,
right,
which is great. That's great, because that's just going to feed into the notion that the strong man needs to be sent back to keep things in order, because chaos of the Democratic Party can't be democratic and can't include more people than just the manifestation of the person being nominated. And that's just...
If you would have asked me a year ago the percent chance that Donald Trump is reelected, I would have said 25.
Yeah.
If you asked me today, I'd say 60.
Really? I still don't feel that it's above 50, but it's I would say that it started at even lower, like I might have given 10% chance, yeah, and now I'm in the 40s.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm not saying that happily, but
let me close this by pointing out one thing. If you and I formed like the Aaron Chuck Whig Party and mm-hmm. we ran for office, and people, you know, we're never going to do this. Scott's looking at us like, really? No, yeah, that would never. We would be horrible politicians. You're first 35. Of all. Yeah, but we would be horrible politicians. Yeah. We both agree that.
Sounds like a good way to get 4.2% in the statewide election, Chuck.
but I want to point this out, because neither Aaron or I nor I are calling for moderation. We're not calling for, you know, you want five, you want zero. Let's compromise 2.5. At 2.5.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. That's a moderate, and neither of us are moderate people. We're actually talking about fundamental radical change in things. We're just not talking about it in, I think, these, and you don't have to agree with this, but I feel like both the Trump language and the Green New Deal language focuses not on what we have in common and our common culture and our common vision for how we can all together prosper in a way that's equitable and fair. And I'm fine going with all that after we have a, you know, this, it's focusing on here's what the proletariat doesn't have. Here's what the bourgeoisie has, or on the Trump side, here's what makes America great. And here's the people trying to take it from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I find both of that set of language, problematic in its division, but I'm a radical at heart. You know, I think neither of us are calling for just split the baby.
I think what we've lost is a sense of governance, is what a governing coalition is and how it might include people who would fight on some issues but be together on other issues. And we've lost the parties as governing coalitions. There's just, they're not coalitions at all. They're cults.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that the answer is the squishiest, most boring, most timid person in the middle is the person that should be in charge. It means that we need to talk and include each other in, like, okay, we're not going to agree on X, Y, or Z, but we're going to, you know, at least maintain a foreign policy. We're going to maintain an economic policy, and we're going to, you know, create a sense of at least we're one country. You know, and that's what I think is being lost in this whole era is the notion that we're one country,
right?
That we're that there's something beyond Democrats and Republicans and our favorite meme to unite us.
Okay, I got another question for another show.
What's okay. that? You got to talk you in the microphone.
Your microphone's off.
Oh, you really? I have to say.
Yeah. Well, you can't just talk in the background.
This is the extra. There are no rules. You can speak.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have a thought for another program.
Okay.
And that is, what's the future of the nation state? You know, I mean,
I think that's a legitimate question.
I like that.
Are nations equipped? And what made me think of it first was talking about Sweden, Minnesota, as opposed to Sweden, United States.
Yeah.
You know,
can't say that about the whole country because our country is so big and weird compared to one. You might compare us to Europe as a continent.
Yeah, there you go.
But you can't compare us to any individual country in Europe.
Because, I would make the argument for city states as like the best form of government.
Yeah.
But, you know, where you go with that. That would be an interesting. We got to do income
typical
inequality.
Of an Athenian like you.
Yeah.
A what?
Athenian. Elitist. So I think another good program would be the prospects of the Minnesota Twins for the upcoming season.
Yeah. My son just came in.
My son is over there. He's
yeah. I gotta head out too.
My point is, he's the Twins guy. I'm officially gonna tap out if I can wave him. He's not looking.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Twins.
The Twins would take 3 or 4 hours.
I think so. At least.
Are the prospects for the Minnesota Twins better than American democracy? Or worse.
Yeah, they're better.
I think they're better. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm glad in a way. That's but like, also sad.
I feel like what you just asked is, will they lose 100 games? And I think they'll be better than
What if it is better for the Twins, but they only win, you know, 65 games on the year? Uh-huh. And that's I think that's a true dystopian
nightmare.
That's
a true
dystopian
nightmare.
You know, what you said about dystopian, the popularity of dystopian novels and TV and radio and movies is really a huge symptom.
Yeah.
Of a,
zombies, man. See, the thing about zombies is...
What do you call it, a zeitgeist or an undercurrent?
We can picture ourselves there. And that's what makes it
creepy,
visceral right now. Yeah, is that like we can actually, it's harder to picture ourselves in happier times in a sense.
Yeah,
you know, like the conflicts that we have are. I think back to when I was a kid, and it was like the 16 candles and I mean those were teen movies, but even like the Red Dawn and Rocky and these were like overcoming the evil other.
Yeah.
And I don't think you could run a movie like that today.
It's too schmaltzy.
Yeah.
Well, even a movie that isn't, you wouldn't call dystopian, say like, and I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard many people talk about the Ballad of Buster Scruggs by the new Coen brothers.
And
the Coen brothers movies in general.
Yeah.
Or a lot of the series that have a dead body on the first scene, and are fun British mysteries or whatever. You know, there's always at the center of things, at least one and sometimes two or three people, good guys and bad guys, with these dark things that haunt them or pull them down. You know, there's not, like you're talking about, you can't make, well, actually, Mary Poppins was a damn good movie. I saw the Mary Poppins.
We took the kids to it.
I thought it was great, you know, but it was definitely.
But that's a throwback.
Yeah. I never saw the first one.
I actually think
it was
that
good.
Saw the first one?
Are you serious?
Thing, no.
Wow. I watched it on repeat 1,000 times when the kids were little. I think that part of the throwback thing, too, and I think this is why you're getting the Marvel Comics stuff, too, as fitting, is an idea of a happier day, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we can kind of relive back when we... I mean, sports is this escapism, too.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Since Donald Trump has been elected, I've exclusively watched SportsCenter in the morning now.
Oh, no, really?
That is directly related.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I've said many times, I have not watched cable news. Mm-hmm. I never do.
Oh, gosh, I don't get any news from television.
Don't.
I will watch.
But I used to.
I watch the 10 o'clock Duluth station for local news, especially breaking stuff. Mm-hmm. In fact, Channel 3 did a wonderful coverage of that explosion in Superior last year. I mean, they did fantastic coverage of that. And I'll watch CCO because my daughter lives down there, so I'll see what's local news in Minneapolis. on TV at night. But in the morning, I get 80% of my news from reading. And I consider NPR like cliff notes to the news.
Right.
And that, by the way, NPR this morning had an interview with a guy who wrote The Uninhabitable Planet. Talk about, and it's about, you know, climate change is going to destroy us.
I only listen, get my news from KXE. I feel like I'm so informed. Because
really?
I'm just joking.
Oh, good.
That would be...
It's my number one broadcast medium.
I will agree with that. That's my number one. I do have to listen to Minnesota Public Radio.
I have a... Kirsty Marone from Collegeville, Minnesota.
Yeah, reporting from Collegeville. Or the attic in our house, whichever.
They've got a few good people working for them.
They got a couple, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you know, their reporters that we've worked with, off the air mostly, have just been really great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very helpful.
I've been on with... I've been on their network.
Do you know what's funny is that, I'm going to say this is going to sound really elitist. You know, you get this too, where like you'll run into people and they'll be like, "Oh, are you Aaron Brown? Like, I really love the Great Northern Radio Show. I really..." And I would, it was kind of, you know, when the kids were growing up, I would run into people and they'd say, "Oh, I hear you on KXE and, you know, And now I don't get it. Like, my wife all the time.
Sure.
And it's kind of fun to be with the kids and be like, "See, mom's famous."
Yeah.
Mom.
Yeah.
So it's part of that, you know, mom is cool, which my daughters need that, right?
Women are cool now, aren't they?
Women are cool. Yeah. And she's, I mean, she's really good at what she does too. Yeah.
It's nice that we let you two guys do this. I think.
I kind of feel like
finding better women. There.
Our stars might be, you know, falling.
I think so.
But at least we're together. You know, this is like,
I was actually thinking about, because when I was in college, there was a sports talk show. It was Joe Soucheray and Patrick Royce. Mm-hmm. And it was Monday nights, and it was just an hour of them. I think they just showed up and talked about sports for an hour. And I listened to that show, and I loved it. It got taken off the air last year. Like this long run, and because the two guys were like just two cranky old guys in the day when we and I was thinking about that show in relation to us, and I thought someday we will be like the novelty show for like two people who still use podcasts, and there'll be some new technology.
Your kids will be doing
actually it might work out that way.
It might be better
to just age out of this thing, you know.
But there'll be some like new technology we refuse to adopt.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, "No, I insist on doing it with the old recorder."
Yeah. We're not doing holograms, you know.
No beaming me up from Brainerd. I'm driving from Brainerd.
Exactly. I'm driving from Brainerd, exactly.
Don't believe what that hologram says. I weigh a lot less than that.
And they'll slowly like phase us out. Like we'll get like worse and worse times.
Yeah.
You know, instead of being on during the morning show,
they'll
have us on like midnight to 1 a.m.
Sunday night.
Yeah. And there'll be some like old, you know, old guy who sits up to listen to it because he's
Tom Brokaw. They wheel him in once in a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, "Oh, there's Tom Brokaw." Remember him?
So here's the thing, though. I'll give you a little insight into 30 years from now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You'll be totally happy with that.
Yeah.
I'll be fine with the phase out.
You look around, see people on their phones, and go, "No problem to me."
Okay.
Yeah. In the end, it'll be a relief. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you can, if your house is warm, you can go to the store.
Yeah, yeah.
You can talk to your kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some basics that would make life miserable for me.
I'm hoping to avoid the guillotine on the way there. That's all. That's my only hope right now, is to avoid the guillotine.
I gotta say, we've chosen the wrong fields, though. We're part we're part of the kind of people who
end up
on the list.
Exactly.
Who end up on the list on both sides. You know,
we're
not totally trustworthy. So, and we're too smart, and so we're gonna go down.
They're gonna line us up against the wall. That's
Plus, you're white guys. You know.
We are. I know. We've got all those hits against us.
I would start coloring your hair.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to do something.
Bug out bag. We got a bug out bag.
Yeah. Canada.
I know the back roads to Canada.
Canada.
Though Canada won't be safe for us.
Probably not.
Whatever takes over, whatever happens here is going to take over.
I just thought of another topic.
What's that?
I'm not. It's population.
Oh, yeah.
When I was born, there were 150 million Americans. There were about 2 billion people on my planet. Now there's 325 million Americans and 7.
Do you want to know the sad truth?
Yeah. I guess.
like Mother Nature has a way of solving that problem.
I know.
And I mean, this is the thing about population control, which is what people talk about. Like, how do we do this? And what you see is that in prosperous societies, you reach this equilibrium where you do, it becomes less like a bike and more like standing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Japan is there and we're there. And we've got some demographic inversions where there's more old people than young people. And so our economy doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason why we couldn't have a different economy that would make that work and function.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting, and I'm really not trying to make too political a point here, more of a historical and economic point, is one thing that's helped this country through in economic growth is immigrants.
Right. No, totally. Right. Mm-hmm.
And
right.
People are, I think a lot of people are unaware of how, when my folks moved to Arizona and retired there, all of a sudden, bingo, the light went on in the mid-70s. I thought, oh.
But when you replace 4.5 million truckers in the next 10 years, immigrants become
even more of a
not
problem.
Really, yeah. It's a completely different conversation.
Yeah. The other thing interesting about immigrants, they, at least in the Vietnamese case, and maybe the Asians, I'm not sure. I know in the Vietnamese case, after the Vietnam War, and in a lot of the Latinos that have come here in the last 30 years, they tend to be family-oriented, religious, entrepreneurs,
right.
and hardworking.
Yeah.
And
but they tend to be great Americans, right?
Well, I was just going to say, and really, I'm not happy at the way what's happened to the Republican Party at all, even though I've rarely voted. But what I'm seeing these people that want to come here that are Republican.
Potential Republican voters.
Republican values. They should be Republican voters.
In so many
right.
ways. Right. And in so many ways that we would benefit from.
Right.
And anyway, but that's just my...
It's funny because this topic is, we've kind of floated all over the place.
Yeah.
But when you when you get into like dystopian nightmares and then you ask a question about population, we more than climate change, which to me has like an adaptation and response to it, the bacterial infection thing does not.
No.
And you know, we've enjoyed 100 years now of the capacity to deal with infection. There's no reason to think that will happen for another 100 years.
You remember, you know who Norman Borlaug was? He was the Minnesota agronomist who supposedly, he got the Nobel Prize in the 60s.
I've heard of some other agronomists, but not him. No, I'm kidding. I have no idea who this person is.
You know who Borlaug is?
No, I don't.
Oh, Borlaug got the Nobel Prize.
We have
Prize.
A long list of agronomists we talked to.
Yeah. Well, he was given
he's my third favorite.
He's the University of Minnesota guy, born in Iowa. He created, he is the...
Are we making fun of the old guy now?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
He's the lead figure in the Green Revolution, and he was right at the Nobel Prize because he developed strains of wheat that could be grown in India and Asia.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Supposedly he saved hundreds of millions of lives.
Sure, sure.
But it was his people working at that time, and he happened to be in the lead. So he came up and spoke at Grand Rapids High School when he was in his 80s.
Wow.
This was in 1990s.
I feel kind of bad for making fun of him right
80s.
Now.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
And so one of the kids was great. Because he's talking about his work. And the kid raises his hand. He's in his 80s. He says, why are you still working on this? And he goes, because what can destroy us is just right around the corner. We got to keep ahead of it.
Right.
And he was...
Totally serious, right.
He was totally serious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think the people at the CDC
right.
are in that kind of mode
well,
every
you,
day,
Well, you hear them, you know, every winter. We go through this period of time where it's like, get the flu shot.
Yeah.
And then you get this whole round of like, this is going to be really bad unless you get the flu shot. And then you get this period where people start getting the flu. And then, you know, this is like a mild winter, but next winter, the strain is going to be worse. And what I'm picking up on is this internal monologue of paranoia because they know that like the 1 year they get it wrong, you're talking about the Spanish flu.
That's
right.
You're right. And then they're going to be blamed, too. And so one reason... But we used to have a guy named... You remember Mike Osterholm? He used to be the state epidemiologist.
I think I might...
I think he's my third favorite.
Okay, after the agronomist? Well, we had him on a few times back in the 90s because he was out front about, I don't know, some disease research. And he's an interesting guy, and he ended up going nationally, maybe at the CDC now, I don't know.